America is a place for everyone. Those who chose this country. Those who fought for it. Some Republicans, some Democrats, and most just somewhere in between. All looking for the same thing. Someone who understands their hopes, their dreams, their pain. To listen. To bring people together. To get up every day and work to make life better for families like yours. To look you in the eye, treat you with respect, and tell you the truth. To work just as hard for the people who voted for him as those who didn't. To be a president for all Americans.
Is that like Radiohead underneath that? Outtake from the Bends? Hi, obviously that was Brad Pitt. America's Brad Pitt in the latest famous Hollywood voice person commercial for the incredibly flush campaign of Joe Biden. We don't talk about campaign finance reform when it's the Democrat who has all the money. But anyways, that was, the latest commercial shown during World Series for Joe, 47 years Biden. Hello, everyone. Howdy, folks. There's just 8 days left of this crap, I swear, except for the Cold War, Civil War afterwards. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I am a babbling Matt Welch, joined by my equally barely keeping it together colleagues, Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue, John Lennon lookalike Ward. Happy birthday, by the way, to my two non-co-authors on this podcast.
Hey, Matt, how are you doing?
Thank you, and howdy.
Thank you, and happy Monday.
Yeah.
Exactly. We are rounding third and stumbling into the home plate of this election like Randy or Rosarina and the stars. my wife and I were talking about this podcast at some point recently, and she was saying who makes who laugh, and it's just like me and Nick tell jokes that the other two to each other that the other two don't even have any idea what we're talking about, and that's the whole point of it. Anyways, the stars increasingly appear to be aligning behind Joe Biden, which is funny because for like four decades before 2012, he was an absolute national politics punchline when it came to the White House. But that changed as of Monday morning, which is when we're talking here. Nate Silver's 538 website puts Mr. Biden at having an 88% chance likelihood of becoming the next president.
What is the likelihood of him living until inauguration, though?
We'll have to go to John Stossel's betting odds, electionbettingodds.com, not to be confused with the .org, and check that out. I think the last likelihood over there was something like 63%, not about living until inauguration day, but certainly about winning the election. I think that we have, and certainly the media has, whether we're the media or not, that's up to you, dear listeners, to decide, but have been talking about Donald Trump constantly. He gobbles the oxygen. He fills people's dreams and nightmares. So let's talk a little bit more today about the guy who is allegedly more likely to be the next president. Catherine, we had a debate 4 days ago, which means that it happened in 2013, probably, between the two presidential candidates. I was struck, I don't know where you were at, but you were the editor that night, so you were paying attention. But I was certainly struck by how much more substantive that it was than, you know, we had grown to expect from the interrupting cow joke of a first debate. This is especially true about the pressing issue for all of us on many levels, which is kind of coronavirus policies, impact, whatever. And aftermaths. What did you glean from the two candidates' treatment of coronavirus-related policy from that debate, if you can remember it all from 7 years ago?
First, I want to say that my kids love the interrupting cow joke and also fail to land the punchline like a solid 70% of the time, which is 10 times funnier than if they did it correctly. So, It is the joke of 2020. It is the joke of 2020 politics, and I support bringing it up henceforth on every podcast. So yeah, I was delighted.
You're just gonna milk it for all it's worth.
No, no.
She can fire you just right here. Like, she has that power.
And I might. I was delighted that there was policy. I was so happy there was policy. I appeared on the newly revived Kennedy show on Fox Business right before the debate. And she said, you know, what are your hopes and dreams? And I was like, just a teeny weeny little bit of policy is all I'm asking for. And I got more than that. So that was delightful. I did not get, however, a lot of information about what Joe Biden would really do if he became president on the most important question facing our nation, which is coronavirus. They have opted, he and Kamala Harris have opted, perhaps understandably, to criticize Trump, to use their kind of 2 minutes in these debates to criticize Trump, and then at the end say, I would do better. I would like a little more information than that. And the back and forth on whether or not there would be a national mask mandate, whether there could be a national mask mandate, is just one aspect of that debate. But I think the way in which Biden has sort of said he would do it in prominent venues, such as at the very end of the Democratic convention, and then seemed to back off it and then leaned back into it, is pretty
leaned back into it. You mean he lost his balance and was falling either forward or back?
Yes. Yes. But he has his life alert, so it's fine.
Nick, I found myself in like the first half of the coronavirus discussion at the debate, kind of both, you know, surprised that it seemed to be semi-substantive, and also kind of more on Team Trump than on Team Biden in talking about kind of lockdowns and schools and other things. And then after a follow-up question, Trump immediately went to like talking down Anthony Fauci, saying that he's a Democrat and all this kind of stuff. And then Biden said one thing, and it's amazing that we've gone this far in the presidential campaign without really hearing, as Catherine notes, anything really about what their policy would be. But he said one thing that I agreed with, which is that we should have more testing. And the Trump White House, for all of its zigging and zagging, continues to talk down testing, including Trump and the campaign trail. What was your takeaway from that aspect of the debate on coronavirus?
You know, I mean, it's consistent with everything else. And it goes to, I think, Catherine's point of, you know, that we've spent a lot of time talking about Trump and much less about Joe Biden. And it's because this election is a referendum on Trump. You know, it's not about Joe Biden. Boy, I'm choking up thinking about President Joe. And, you know, Joe Biden wins because of that, because if you look at what he is actually saying, and I spent a good chunk of Friday and the weekend going through his vision tab, you know, a vertical on his website, Joe's vision, that, you know, it's like the space elevator in, you know, the Douglas Adams books. I mean, this thing goes up to Uranus and back. It is awful. And Joe Biden, as befits an 80-year-old man, is going to be throwing a weighted blanket over every aspect of our lives. That's what I got out of both the debate, but more importantly, out of the Biden presidency, which is upon us. I mean, I'm happy to say I fully expect Joe Biden to win the presidency. I fully expect the Democrats to take the Senate. And when you start to look at, you know, the $11 trillion in new spending that he's promising by, you know, various calculations, and if you look at any aspect of what he's talking about, it is going to be a different type of, you know, a different type of torpor will be across the country. It'll be laid on top of the coronavirus, but he is going to be getting into every dimension of our activity.
I saw Genesis on the different kind of torpor tour in 1978, and it was outstanding. You were saying, sorry?
No, I'm just, you know, that Biden has something to say about every interaction, every aspect of American society that you can imagine. And it's worth going through his page to get ready to figure out what's going on. I'll make a call back to something Peter during the Democratic debate season or primary season, which is 1,000 years ago. I think we were still in the Bronze Age or something when that took place. But he had mentioned that when Elizabeth Warren talked about American kind of capitalism, she saw the government as having to be in between every buyer and seller, every employer and employee in the marketplace. That is all folded into Joe Biden's vision, as it's laid out on his campaign website. And it's a disturbing thing. To take one specific example, he pledges to aggressively pursue employers who violate labor laws, participate in wage theft, or cheat on their taxes by intentionally misclassifying employees as independent contractors. So the horrible debate that is happening in California about whether or not Uber and Lyft and you know, various kinds of food delivery services should be giving full benefits, healthcare and retirement plan that is in California right now is going to be everywhere around the country.
Peter, you shared on Slack, and I can talk about this, I think.
Go for it.
The Mark Meadows exchange with Jake Tapper, which I couldn't watch because it was one of those cable news exchanges that we've come to. I can do that again if you need.
Thank you. Please do.
Sorry.
That was a really good impression, to be fair.
I think that might be the voice for a new Animaniacs character.
Mark.
Animaniacs is coming back, right?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
And obviously, intrinsically more interesting than anything that we've talked about so far.
Yeah. Anyways, Mark Meadows, White House Chief of Staff, I think, was saying that we can't control the coronavirus, which is sort of different than the messaging from the Trump White House. Using that as a backdrop, the Trumpian policy, what have you gotten from Joe Biden in terms of coronavirus policy or related healthcare policies that are of interest, considering that he has a between 63% and 88% chance of becoming the next president? Peter Stewart.
Well, as I noted back in August, again, millions and millions of years ago, right after the Democratic National Convention, Joe Biden gave this long prepared speech that night, you know, and a lot of to the extent that there was a policy content or a policy argument being made throughout the Democratic National Convention, it was that Joe Biden would be better about managing the coronavirus. And his plan, as described in the speech, which was, again, 45 minutes, an hour long, I don't remember, it's a long speech, not quite as long as Trump's, as I recall, was a total of 131 words. And there just wasn't that much to it. It was, we want to do rapid tests, we're going to make medical supplies available to the places that need them, no sort of mechanism there, we're going to make sure our schools have resources, I guess that's more money for something. We'll put politics aside. That's part of the plan. They're not going to have politics involved in their politics. And they're going to have, and again, this was back in August. This is, I think, maybe not the campaign's current position, but these are the words that Joe Biden spoke just 2 months ago in a major address. We'll have a national mandate to wear a mask. And this is part of the problem for Joe Biden is that he is running on, I will be better at managing the coronavirus, while also not providing a huge number of specific policy details about how he would do that in a way that is different from what Donald Trump has already done. Now, the best case he made at the debate last week was that he wouldn't be kind of crazy about some of this stuff. He wouldn't say, hey, maybe we should drink bleach, which Trump now says is a joke. Go back and watch the clip. It's not entirely clear. It's a joke. Right. That he would take White House protocols for virus management, more seriously, that sort of thing, that he would simply be a more responsible and sane person when it comes to managing the pandemic. That's an argument. I think there's some real truth to that, just that Joe Biden is much more of a conventional politician who has conventional political management experience in ways that are both good and bad relative to Trump. But it's not nearly as strong an argument as I think he would like you to think he has in terms of managing the pandemic.
I think Trump's finest moment in the debate was when he said, Joe Biden has no plan to open up society, to open up America. And because, as Peter says, Biden's plan is essentially what Trump is doing without all of the, insane tap dancing and hand waving and polemics. And, that may be the best that we're going to do. And when Mark Meadows, I find it kind of strange that, you know, him saying we're not going to control the pandemic becomes a breakout headline and things like that. Because what he's basically, you know, what he said is we're going to try and mitigate it through, you know, coming up with ways to treat this stuff and come up with a vaccine and kind of do what we're doing, which in my mind is too much. I mean, Trump is at his strongest when he says, you know, we have to start opening things up. I agreed with him completely on that. And I think he's right. We shut down too much, too fast without any kind of scrutiny or understanding. And we need to be opening things up and learning how to move on from the current state of affairs in America. And Trump, and Biden, again, is he's a smart politician. He's, you know, he's been in politics 10 years longer than the median age of people in America. This guy knows how to survive. He's not promising anything. He's just making sure he's not Donald Trump. But I think, you know, that was a stark moment that opened the debate. And it's a cautionary tale. I mean, Biden doesn't have any idea of what he's going to do that's different than what we've seen.
On the one hand, I think Biden does have a little bit of a point, just that Trump has consistently been overly optimistic about how this is going to go, you know, saying, I mean, here is from the debate. He's saying, oh, by the way, Trump's the same fellow who told you this is going to end by Easter. Same fellow who told you, don't worry, we're going to end this by the summer. Right. You had all that. You had those Woodward quotes about how Trump knew at the time that it was going to be quite a big deal and then chose to downplay it. But then Joe Biden follows up immediately right after that with, we're about to go into a dark winter. And it's a dark vision for managing this and for getting through it, that I think is actually somewhat, I find that as somewhat disturbing, I am not at all comforted by Donald Trump, but I find it somewhat disturbing that Biden has such a dark cast of mood when it comes to this.
Well, he has no, you know, the main thing that can be done and should be done quickly, all of the evidence points in this direction, is that schools K through 12 and certainly, you know, K through 5 or schools should be opened up. You know, everybody, all of the expert analysis, whatever the hell that's worth, you know, points to the idea that these are not places that are spreading the virus. There's a lot of negative outcomes, you know, both now and down the road, God help us, about keeping, you know, K through 12 schools, certainly the lower grades, closed. And there is no interest on the part of Joe Biden or the Democratic Party to do that, because the biggest block in that way are teachers unions, who absolutely own huge swaths of the Democratic Party. And, you know, this is a question. I've been wrestling with this for a long time, and I'm curious what you guys are doing in your personal lives. We cannot continue to live as if we're waiting to see when this is going to end, or when, you know, how do we start our lives again? Like, we're just sitting around while, you know, we're going totally sideways. We need to start acting as if our lives are still our own and that we can get out and start doing stuff. And you know, to your point, Peter, Trump is overly optimistic. There's no question about it. He's a blowhard and a liar, and he speaks out of his ass, you know, far more than his mouth and all too much all the time. But, you know, I'd rather be on the side of somebody who's saying, you know, at this point anyway, that, you know, we've got to get through this. We've got to learn to live with it, and we've got to get on with our lives.
Don't you think we're just overvaluing the role of the president in solving this problem in this conversation, though? Like, you know, the United States is a widely variable place. You can see that just, you know, Donald Trump is president everywhere, but what's going on in South Dakota right now is very different than what's going on in New York. And I think it's very tempting
there, I agree,
to say, if we had, you know, an executive who had a clear plan that was executing it competently, we would be in a very different position. And that may be true, you know, that in fact things would be quite different. At the same time, if Joe Biden was president right now, and even if he did consistently implement a much more aggressive disease control program, I don't know what would happen at the state level and at the local level. And I think it's really important to keep that in mind. I think people have this fantasy of either Sweden or New Zealand, and the United States is
I agree with you, Catherine,
but doesn't that mean though that what Biden is saying is that you take the most restrictive place, or a Biden victory, again, which I think is a fait accompli, he's going to be working to give us the most restrictive version of a response to the pandemic.
Well, I would put it
all everywhere.
But in the same way that Donald Trump wanted to have everything open by Easter and couldn't implement that, Joe Biden might want to have everyone locked down with masks on, but he can't implement that.
shut up.
I mean,
what he can't implement, Catherine, I'm sorry, it wasn't for Peter, it was for all of you, is that, as Peter was saying before, he can, especially if Democrats take the Senate, which they are looking likely to do, implement a big old bailout to state education budgets and local education budgets, which would be a large expenditure of money, probably even a reward system on some level for the very polities and places where they have, I think, erroneously locked down. You know, if you, Corey DeAngelis has done really good work for the Reason Foundation, which is the nonprofit 501c3 that publishes this podcast, if that makes sense, on pointing out that if you look, what is the biggest variable on which school districts are open and closed? It ain't the virus. It ain't the science. It's the power of the teachers union. And Joe Biden and the Democratic Party, and I will ask you to respond to this, Catherine, compared to even 10 years ago, is way more in hoc to teacher union desires. And so we would likely see this thing, a big bailout of that. And isn't that, in fact, bad? Or do you think that maybe it's even good, Catherine Negu Ward?
So I think a lot of people on the local level are realizing maybe for the first time the power of teachers unions. I mean, I'm getting, you know, emails from my kids' school and school district on the regular, which reveal that power increasingly explicitly, I would say, as negotiations get more tense in the places that schools are still closed. Which it behooves us coastal elites on this podcast to remember is not everywhere. Lots of places are open right now. But I think there's going to be a real lag between when regular Americans start to be like, hey, maybe teachers unions don't totally have like my kids' interests at their core. And when elected Democratic politicians can say anything like that out loud or act on that realization, because as you say, teachers unions are incredibly powerful donors, and there will be big spending in response to that, as there always is. And this is a big concern with the Biden administration in general. Like, a lot of Democratic constituencies need to get their payoff if he wins, and this happens every time, right? This is not unique to Biden, but there are a lot of pent-up regulations, there is a lot of pent-up subsidy that is expected to come due. There will be a lot of executive action and regulatory action that will happen under a Biden administration just because he is a Democrat and the Democrats have certain obligations and commitments to their special interests.
Peter,
just to go back to your question a little bit earlier, Matt, you know, one thing we know that Joe Biden would do, at least if he has a Democratic Senate and Democratic House, is that he would almost certainly sign the HEROES Act or something like it, which is the nth wave Democratic COVID relief bill, about $3.3 trillion, about $1 trillion of which is aid to states and localities. Now, that's not all school funding, but a lot of it would end up going to be school funding, going to, probably because money is fungible, end up helping states pad out their public pension programs, that sort of thing. And it is notable, again, to go back to the speech he gave in August, where he had just this really small list of things that he wanted to do. And one of them was make sure schools have the resources they need. Now, it's resources they need to be open, safe, and effective, but resources for schools. That is pretty clear language saying that one of his few priorities is spending money on education, on teachers unions. It's giving money to teachers unions. That's what that is telling us. And that is a shout out to the teachers unions that are now one of the core Democratic Party constituencies.
I want to continue kind of imagining a Biden presidency in terms of policy. Excuse me, I got what Nick has and whatnot, but also like what that will look like as a political culture. And one thing that grabbed my attention this morning was a piece in Persuasion by career, lifelong, even longer than Joe Biden's lifetime in Washington, centrist Norm Ornstein. And Nick, I'm going to invite you to have your blood boiled. I'll read a little bit of this. He's writing it today. Before long, all of us will confront a brutal reality. Donald Trump stays in office until January 20th and will do what he can to leave the government as a scorched earth. For his successor, one part of our long national nightmare will end then at noon on January 20th, but another part of the brutal reality will set in. Even if Democrats have a dream election, they would get up to 53 Democrats in the Senate, meaning that 47 Republicans will still be there. Biden will likely face a Supreme Court with 6 of its 9 justices set on limiting any ambitious plans he has, joined by an army of right-wing judges at appeals courts and blah, 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 blah. So are you ready for 4 years of that kind of being the media default, Nick, and what will that do to your blood pressure?
Yeah, you know, it won't do anything to my blood pressure, Matt. I emptied my blood and it's just sand now. I'm much more comfortable. I have a little bit, you know, it's less volatile and I don't have the energy, but I also, you know, no longer have to worry about that.
And now you're a percussion instrument as well.
Yeah,
which is very
useful. So it is, you know, let's forget Norm Ornstein for a while, although you're absolutely right that you know people are already, you know, front loading an argument like the post office has to front load its pension and health care requirements for a decade or whatever, that the Biden presidency will be a failure because the Republicans somehow blocked it, even though they don't have power. The fact is that Biden's going to get in and he's almost certainly going to get in and he's almost certainly going to have 2 years like Obama did in 2008 to 2010 or 2009 to 2011 of getting everything he wants. And then the Democrats will be voted out, not in spite of the ability of Biden and the Democrats to do everything they want, but precisely because of that. And this time, the stakes are even higher because it is, you know, Joe Biden is the $11 trillion man. You know, and he's going to do everything he can and he's going to pass everything that they can. And it's going to be a real shit show.
I think it's actually going to be presuming he wins, the Democrats win the House and the Senate. I think that it will actually be even more of a progressive policy festival than the first 2 years of the Obama administration, where he had 60 votes in the Senate for it for the first almost a year. And it actually he spent most of that time trying to pass the healthcare law and didn't really get it done. It came through, a version of it came through at the very end of December in the Senate, and then it didn't pass in the House until March. And then they were able to pass Dodd-Frank in the summer after that. They did start with the stimulus, which was about $900 billion. But I think things will just move much more quickly through a fully Democratic Congress this time, and you won't have the kind of angst and soul searching that held up the healthcare bill and sort of wasted, or at least took up much of the first year of Obama's presidency.
Yep. And think about that: you go from $900 billion, you know, is the ante, and they had to struggle for that, and they were, you know, that was partly set by a lot of Bush policy procedures, but now you're talking like out of the gate, it's going to be the $3.3 trillion. You know, and that'll be passed very quickly.
And you have no meaningful break on the other end of it, because, I mean, Republicans will presumably, and there's already been some kind of sideways crab-like motions getting ready for this. They'll presumably start talking about the debt and deficit again. But like people are, the laugh track to that is
as it should be. I mean, this
thunderous.
Is, you know, let's. Bring in an unlikely suspect to blame for all of this, which is Mitch McConnell, you know, who is now appearing in photographs with what looks to be like a gangrenous limb. If you've seen those pictures of Mitch McConnell floating around the internet, but his, you know, he's the master of strategy and all of that kind of stuff. And all he was doing is kind of, you know, holding things back until there is an explosion, because he's really a terrible human being and a terrible politician who does not care about America. He cared about keeping Republicans, no matter how awful they are, in kind of legislative power at all times. And I think he deserves a lot of the blame for what is going to be coming.
I have written negative things
I've
about...
I've also been struck, though, by how incredibly, wildly mean-spirited people have been about whatever is going on with his health right now. It seems to me to be the same as the Amy Coney Barrett, like, handmade stuff. Like, there's all these people in my Twitter feed saying, while I believe it's deeply wrong to criticize people for unchosen characteristics... And then saying something really, really horrible about basically like Republicans, because obviously they don't deserve basic human like kindness and politeness. And, you know, this like Amy Coney Barrett's eyes are dead and she's wearing handmade red and like McConnell is a zombie rotting from the inside out due to his bad principles. Like, I don't know. I guess maybe it's just this season, but I'm like particularly struck by how it is like 100% against the rules to talk about anyone's appearance unless they're, I guess, a bad Republican.
Yeah. It's not a good season. I had like several people super angry at me today, like on Twitter, and saying that I'm a terrible, useless hack and obviously not a good journalist because I tweeted out the quote and the word "we" based on a Washington Post thing saying, you know, we still watch Saturday Night Live and the 60 Minutes to see, you know, where to take our political cues from or something like that. And I was just like, we. And that's it. Like angry journalists, like, you know, calling me out, denouncing me, unfollowing me. Very like people are losing their ever loving minds.
Can you name names, Matt Welch?
I don't want you to name names. I literally want you to explain why.
I don't know.
Why are people so mad?
They're just mad.
60 Minutes and SNL are American institutions, Catherine.
Right.
I think they're mad because Swin was the one who retweeted it, and he's got a lot of garbage followers, so I blame him. Anyways, Peter, you were about to, surprisingly for you, you were about to interrupt what Catherine was saying. Well, do you want to finish whatever thought that you might have had?
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, I'm concerned, actually, for Mitch McConnell's health. I think it's I'm worried by the fact that neither he nor his staff is explaining what's going on there. But also, you know, Nick, look, your attack on Mitch McConnell there is, on the one hand, quite warranted in a lot of ways. I have written a lot of relatively fair, quite mean stuff about critical stuff about Mitch McConnell over the years. And yet, if I were to, I think you can also make a defense of him, even maybe not quite from a libertarian perspective per se, but from a perspective that appreciates some libertarian goals, particularly when it comes to the judiciary. And McConnell has basically decided to completely ignore the economic fiscal side of policy, or at least just do whatever is, as you said, necessary to hold Republican seats. I think that's been bad. I think it's been bad for governance. It's bad for the budget. It's going to be bad for our economic futures. At the same time, he has also decided to prioritize the judiciary and filling seats there. And Trump has maybe not personally decided to prioritize that in the way that a traditional politician would, but has seen that himself as a path to victory. And it has reshaped the judiciary probably in ways that are going to down to the benefit of libertarian policy goals more often than not. Maybe not always. Certainly, there's going to be some significant exceptions there. And I still think, you know, as I've said on this podcast before, that there is just the possibility of political blowback that is going to haunt us for years and years, and that could be problematic as well. At the same time, there is something to be said. Not everything, but something to be said for that strategy. And Mitch McConnell is the one who executed it and decided on it.
And I do think that one small silver lining is that, you know, the Trump's record on the judiciary is from a libertarian point of view, because who cares about conservatives, liberals, Democrats, and Republicans? From a libertarian point of view, the judiciary he put in place, including Amy Coney Barrett, is going to be better than what would have happened otherwise. And to the extent that McConnell made that happen, good for Mitch.
In conclusion, but Gorsuch.
Catherine, as our resident, hey, look at me. I'm not only not voting, but you're probably voting for bad reasons, person.
Yep. That's
another
me.
Reason TV Present. Can't stop it with this stuff. Catherine, I want you to, or I'm going to invite you to comment on a twin pair of articles or arguments that came out today, which one literally the headline on a Rich Lowry National Review piece talking about Donald Trump is the only middle finger available. This is basically a voting argument for Donald Trump, although the column wasn't precisely that. But it's sort of like saying that if he wins, this is why, that it's a middle finger to the cultural and woke elites in the world trying to keep us all down. And the mirror image of this is in The Atlantic by Yasha Munk. I think we should add more syllables to his name. Yasha Munk. Saying, hate wokeness, vote Biden. What are your perceptions on using kind of wokeness, cancel culture, whatever, which we cover and write about a lot at Reason. In fact, sort of in a trailblazing type of way with Robbie Swabie and other people. What do you see that as a motivation to vote one way or the other?
I'm going to start with a snippy remark that it's almost like people retroactively justify their decision to vote for one of two imperfect teams with a bunch of elaborate rationalizations that don't reflect the reality either of the underlying politics or of the possibility that their vote will have an impact on those issues. It's almost like that. Second,
that's,
I guess
that's snippy. That was well put. Go on.
It was a little snippy because I do feel snippy about it. I mean, we put up a video last week in which I once again made my sort of round of arguments for not voting, and lots of people responded to it in ways that suggested that they, among other things, didn't actually watch the video, which is pretty typical and how things go. If we have to pick one way to use our vote to signal that we are against wokeness, or perhaps more broadly, progressive leftism, which is not quite the same thing, but I think these two arguments are using those things somewhat interchangeably. I think the vote for Biden is where I would go, if for no other reason than that is essentially managing editor Stephanie Slade's potential argument for voting for Biden. She remains, remained undecided the last time we talked. But she basically said, listen, if Biden wins, the Democratic Party will take that as a signal that they don't need to go further left to win. I think that is true about whether or not, about what will happen if Biden wins. I don't think, of course, that any specific individual vote
What is the argument that Joe Biden winning, because in his lifetime he's, you know, raised glasses with segregationists and eulogized Strom Thurmond, that he is not going to be an agent of radical elements in the Democratic Party, including the woke people and the AOC brigade, and that he's going to stamp out identity politics in the Democratic Party? That seems like a real stretch.
Well, I think the argument is, and I've written about this as well, is that there was a woke primary in the Democratic primary, and everyone who ran on that stuff lost, and Joe Biden won. He was the one guy who was not very online. He was the one guy being attacked by Kamala Harris for, you know, having terrible retrograde.
The vice president.
Yeah. All right. So, I mean, yeah. The idea is that
she's just going to shut up and do what she's told.
No, you asked what you asked what the thinking is. I'm not saying that I agree necessarily with the thinking.
Yeah. But again, both Matt and I here are channeling
an argument.
No,
I understand
argument,
that, but let's evaluate that argument. That argument seems flimsy at best.
Would love
right?
to. Nope.
Well, I mean, that's the Trump counterpoint, and you can see him trying to do this, but it's hard as well to say that, you know, Joe Biden is going to be steamrolled by where the left is going. And I think that is a big legitimate concern about Biden. But again, Biden's counterargument is that I won. The people doing that didn't. And the question, and one of the great questions of, if we agree with my one good metaphor for a year, which is that Joe Biden is a rusty weather vane, whether the wind is going to overpower where the needle's going to go. And I think the cultural question is much broader than the Democratic Party politics or, you know, machinery question. I think the Democratic Party as an apparatus is much less woke than where the culture is going, where the median, you know, New York Times editorial employee is going. But there's more of that. And that is, I think, definitely washing over institutions in a way that is weird and will have power and will have backlashes associated with it. Peter, jump in here and interrupt me.
I mean, I think the way I would look at this is not through the lens of wokeism exactly, but through the lens of democratic leftism, progressive policymaking. And if you look at probably the biggest, most frequent policy argument during the primaries, which are sort of the relevant unit of time to be looking at and the relevant kind of argument to be looking at here, it was about healthcare. And on the one hand, you had the Bernie Sanders Medicare for All plan, which is, you know, $30-something trillion over a decade, and it would have outlawed private insurance in about 4 years for the most part. And then you have the Biden plan, and there's an interesting exchange at this last debate last week in which Trump says, oh, look, your plan would outlaw private insurance for about 180 million people. That's not true. Trump is attacking Biden on on the basis of Bernie's plan. And when you say that to Trump, Trump basically says, well, it doesn't matter because, you know, Kamala Harris backed the plan and the rest of your party wants to do it and you want to do it. And like, Trump is wrong here. At the same time, Trump has a grain of a, maybe a couple of grains of a point, which is that Biden did, his campaign did produce a unity document with the Bernie campaign after winning. His healthcare plan is not a $30 trillion Medicare for All plan. What it is a plan to expand Medicare by lowering the Medicare age, expand government health insurance by setting up a public option, which is just a government-run insurance plan that competes with private insurance. He's also going to expand subsidies through Obamacare. And notably, he's going to make it possible for people who are currently on private employer-sponsored insurance to jump off their employer-sponsored insurance while keeping the same job and go into subsidized Obamacare plans. And what all of that is going to do is it is going to have the effect of weakening private insurance. It's going to degrade the private insurance system and pull people off of private plans, which, yes, if you're getting your insurance through your employer, it's being implicitly subsidized by the tax break that's been there since World War II. But it's going to pull people off of their current private plans and put them onto either explicit government plans like Medicare or the public option, or explicitly subsidized plans through the Obamacare exchanges, which basically have turned private individual market health insurance into a kind of quasi-public utility because those plans are so regulated that there's almost no sort of plan design choice that insurers can make. And so what he has done there is not embrace full Bernie and not embrace, you know, the fullness of the progressive left, but he's taken the party steps toward it. More steps toward it. And so there's like this tension between, yes, he's not the wokest candidate. He's not the most progressive left candidate. And in many ways, he was the most moderate of the actual plausible contenders for winning the primary. On the other hand, he is much more progressive than many previous Democrats, and he is taking the party in a leftist direction.
Well put, Peter Suderman. All right, let's go to our end of a podcast, what we have been consuming culturally. Segment, which I think it's catchy descriptions.
I watched the sequel to the Borat movie, a subsequent movie film, and I was curious to see it. Sacha Baron Cohen, I think, is remarkably funny, and I was a huge fan of Ali G way back in the day. I watched the movie. I think it's worth watching because it. You know, it's first off, it's a many after years, 14 years after the fact sequel to a movie that was kind of a cultural watershed. Like most late breaking sequels, this is more Godfather 3 than Godfather 2. But, you know, it takes the temperature, I think, of, you know, a lot of people in the country. I found it it's not as good or as fresh as the first one, partly because almost all of its humor is just very pointedly at the expense of kind of dumb Americans who are also conservative. And they kind of shine through. Most of the people he engages kind of are being nice or trying to be. But it was worth watching. Kind of funny and not that great.
Peter, what have you been gobbling up?
There was a new Tana French novel released this month. And so, of course, I have been reading it. It's called The Searcher. It is her eighth novel. The first six were in a sort of linked, loosely linked series called the Dublin Murder Squad books, each of which featured a protagonist who was a minor character in a previous book, right? So it was never the same hero, but you would have a character who was a little bit familiar to you, who you would get to know a little bit better. This book and her last book, The Witch Elm, are not Dublin Murder Squad books, but they are set in Ireland. This one is set in sort of the Irish countryside. It's about an ex-Chicago cop who moves to a sort of small town in Ireland and gets caught up in a mystery. It's a fascinating and wonderfully engaging book. Just the most sheerly pleasurable novel I think I've read all year long, and one of her best works because of the way that it sort of insists on people's uniqueness and individuality, even while understanding that they are products of their place and their culture. And it's all about this kind of tension between place and person, and the ways that place shapes you and makes you who you are. And she's really just sort of a great a great capturer of the weirdness and eccentricity and lovable, sort of how people can be both lovable and also kind of evil in certain ways, or at least, you know, have dark secrets, which I won't reveal here, but strongly recommend it for any fan of really engaging crime fiction and Town of French.
Boom. Catherine Mankiw Ward, besides the glories of Rock Creek Park, what did you consume this week?
I definitely consume the glories of Rock Creek Park. As we have discussed, I am now a nature person, sort of. And I enjoyed the DC-specific graffiti I saw there, including some QAnon graffiti, always good. Got an opportunity to attempt to explain to my husband what the tag "Who is Q" might mean, which was a real extremely online person talks to extremely real life person type conversation, which we frequently
did you use the lifeline of calling Jesse Walker on the speakerphone?
You know, I could have. I think that might have made it worse, to be quite honest. Like, never don't refer to Jesse Walker in understanding conspiracies, but also the spontaneous phone a friend of Jesse Walker, I think, could end badly. I too began to read the new Town of French novel, but what I want to talk about is I finally watched Moonlight, which I know that thing, you know, was winning prizes so deep into the before times that I can't even remember what life was like then.
Was that the first talkie to win Best Picture?
It was the first talkie. Yeah, they retired all those you know, little piano players from the movie theaters and debuted Moonlight. It deserves the awards that it won, guys. I guess what I'm saying here is, if you didn't watch this movie because it seemed to you that it was going to be worthy yet depressing,
that was me.
Then you are not wrong, but you should watch it anyway in a moment when you are feeling psychologically strong. Like, it's worth it, even though it is worthy yet depressing. It's like worth it on the like aesthetic and pleasurable level, as well as on the worthiness level. And especially for people who are fans of this podcast and Reason, there's really a lot of good, subtle treatment of what it means to be involved in the economy of illegal drugs. As a consumer, as a seller, as a bystander, I think that often those treatments in fiction are too simplistic, and this movie does not make that mistake. So Moonlight, you heard it here first from me, is a pretty good movie.
For a second there,
Mahershala Ali is so good in the first third of that movie. It's just astounding. I mean, he's good in everything, but it's like, he's one of those actors who will take not great material and make it really great, and then when he gets great material or even pretty good material, it's like, oh my god.
Catherine, when you first started saying this, I thought you finally saw Moonstruck, and I was gonna give you
honestly
serious points,
like,
for that.
Give me next week, I'll check back in, maybe. Yeah. I'll go for like a theme here. I'll see Moonstruck this week and report back.
And can you read "The Moon is a Harsh Mistress" along with it?
I've been there, baby. I done been there.
Yeah, that's an easy one. Moonstruck, in addition to giving us the immortal line "snap out of it" from Cher to Nicolas Cage, it was shot in a local bakery here in Carroll Gardens, Brooklyn, that you can visit to this day. I watched nothing of value. My Rock Creek Park was Central Park, though, by the way. And again, just a plug to especially New York listeners, now is the time to make your tourisms. It's a really, really good time because there's no tourists, not many, and it's nice outside still, and go do the things that you wouldn't do otherwise because you thought it was going to be too crowded. The whole economy is wrecked. However, it's a good time to do tourisms. The end. No, what I watched was, I've been watching the World Series, the baseballs, the sports balls, and it's been great. I have been watching it with more avid interest than I remember in a really long time, partly because it's been a particularly great game. The game four, even all of you who don't care anything about sports, which is at least half of this podcast, just go on YouTube and say game four ending and watch the last play of game four. And I'm not going to spoil it, what happens. actually came by. I was at
what kind of world are we living in where you can't tell what happened in a game that is well done with
a great world, Nick, a world in which you want to share pleasure with your fellow human beings. I was at a church on Sunday, and there was talking to the sports ball friend guy who's there, and he was talking to another sports ball friend guy who went to sleep in the eighth inning. And we're like, oh my God, so great. Don't listen to anybody. Go home and watch it. Watch the rest of it. Super fun, but also just been great. Sports turns out to be pretty good, especially in these troubled times. And also I identify with the hair goals of most of the Dodgers players and bandana wearing. That's all the bandana wearing we have time for now, at least until we get into video. Are we doing a video for our Webathon special podcast? Does anyone know, Nick?
I believe we are planning to.
I believe there will be some cameras involved. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's is something to look forward to. And as part of that, and also we might start folding this in more regularly. We're going to be soliciting your questions. Generally speaking, especially for the Webathon when it comes in, maybe make it kind of a more regular thing. You can start just by sending them to me right now, matt.welch@reason.com is my email address. But send some feedback, some questions that you want to hear about Nick's cat and other related details. That's all the time we have for. Listen to all our podcasts, reason.com podcasts, including the recent interview with Nick Gillespie and the Soho Forum debates series. We'll see you next Monday, which will be the day before, and we'll see how normal we are then. Goodbye.